Well, hello and welcome to the June edition of the Mixed Media Audio Zine. It's a monthly radio show about underground and small press publications, radio news, and new independent music. It's a blend of paper culture and radio. I'm your host, DJ Frederick, and I want to thank you for tuning in. I'd like to start off this month's program with a reading from the blog for the documentary film Corporate.fm. Radio has a unique relationship with locality. Unlike Facebook or web-based music sharing applications, locally owned radio reaches thousands of people across many incomes and ages in a single area at the same time with a message unique to that area. That ability is what once moved entire cities to unite around local bands, local charities, local businesses, and new ideas. The internet may have some advantages, such as connecting individuals over long distances, but it cannot create a vast, localized unity the way radio can. The local limitations of a radio tower are actually its greatest asset, because the station transmits primarily within a community and is free to everyone inside the community. When stations are locally owned, there is motive to improve the station and the community together. If owners live in town, they can plainly see that using the station to help their community to grow will in turn earn local support for their station as a business. Local owners also get to see the ways that the station can help the community that does not have direct financial benefit, such as with increased civic pride and communal unity. Multiple local owners create competition to be the most local or the most in tune with the population. This is why rock stations once promoted local bands. They didn't want the competing stations to discover the local talent first. That motive is gone with consolidation. DJ Michael Halloran put it this way: if the owner of the Denver Broncos owned every other team, which team would he be passionate about? And that's from the blog for the documentary film Corporate.fm. And before we get to some zines and some zine readings, I want to let you know about the Pirates Week podcast with Ragnar. Absolutely fantastic podcast that's available at www.piratesweek.info. The June edition of the Pirates Week has information about medium wave Euro Pirates and an online newspaper called the Shortwave Listening Journal, information about the Senate approval of two new FCC commissioners, select postings from the Free Radio Network and the HF Underground, and also off-air recordings of Undercover Radio, Radio Mushroom, Radio Ronin, and Channel Z. They also take a look at the FM pirate station WSQT operating in Washington, D.C. And that's the Pirates Week with Ragnar at piratesweek.info. You're listening to the Mixed Media Audio Zine for June 2012. And since it is June, we're going to hear a tune by that name, by Tom and Liv.
Thank you.
June by Tom and Liv on the Mixed Media Audio Zine.
The station specifically designed to help the world's blind and sighted communities see eye to eye, this is the Global Voice.
I have a reading for you now from Finite and Flammable, a zine about zines which was recently published and is available from Microcosm. These are some excerpts from Obscure Memories by Jim Romanesco. In 1989, my former Milwaukee magazine colleague Simon sent me a copy of Fact Sheet 5, the incredible catalog of fanzines that listed hundreds, if not thousands, of publications. The catalog's great, I thought, but where's the trade publication for fanzines? I couldn't find it, so I started one called Obscure Publications. I published it for about a decade before taking it online in 1998. Here are a few obscure memories from those years. Once a month or so, I'd get a call from Fact Sheet 5 publisher Seth Friedman, who'd want to gossip about zine publishers. At some point, he stopped calling, and I don't know why. Several years ago, I was in Evanston, Illinois, in a theater watching Capturing the Friedmans, the documentary about a Long Island man and his son accused of child molestations. There was a reference to another son, Seth, who didn't cooperate with the filmmaker. I realized that son was Fact Sheet 5 Seth, and that he had stopped calling me about the time work on the film began. I never heard from him again. My best-selling issue of Obscure Publications was the Jeffrey L. Dahmer murder issue. I had covered Jeffrey Dahmer's trial for Milwaukee Magazine, and was assigned a front-row courtroom seat that I shared with Vanity Fair and Wisconsin Public Radio. Dahmer's parents were seated directly behind me. During the trial, I collected various souvenirs, including the serial killer's confession, dozens of pages long, the police reports, and Xeroxed photographs of Dahmer's victims, various body parts. It was perfect Obscure Publications material. I did a document dump for my Jeffrey L. Dahmer murder file issue, which sold for years after its first press run. I got to know Dishwasher Pete, whose zine Dishwasher was about his attempt to wash dishes in restaurants in all 50 states. He became something of a mainstream media favorite, which I knew made him uncomfortable because of his shyness. He was on This American Life, much to my surprise, and was scheduled to be on David Letterman's show. I watched the segment and saw a stocky guy being introduced as Dishwasher Pete. I knew Pete was very slim and that something was up here. It was. Pete had sent a ringer to do the show, which got national press and, I suspect, helped his book. In the mid-1990s, book publishers discovered zines and signed some of the more famous zinesters, including current Playboy advisor Chip Rowe, who had long published Chip's Closet Cleaner. And that's an excerpt from Obscure Memories by Jim Romanesco from the zine Finite and Flammable. This is DJ Frederick, and you are listening to the Mixed Media Audio Zine for June 2012. We're going to go back a few years to a reading of a zine that was published around 2006, Old Weird America, read by Rose White.
I'm Rose White, and I'm going to be reading from my zine, Old Weird America, issue number 1. postcards from a ghost town. Richie the dog guy across the street died yesterday. From AIDS, I guess. Loreen told me this in her usual blunt way. Well, girl, I guess you won't be talking to Richie no more. I had always thought he was invincible because he walked his four big black dogs barefoot down the alley behind 51st Street, oblivious to the broken glass and used condoms along the way. He sometimes carried a big stick, so along with the dogs, I thought of him as a sort of shepherd. The dogs were pit bull, Rottweiler mixes, but docile, and he controlled them with a series of whistles and calls. If I was across the street, he'd whistle at them so that they would run over to me and swarm me to be petted, and then he'd whistle for them to come back and cry in a high, sing-songy voice, "Come on, my babies! Come here, babies! Come on!" Now, I imagined, the babies were in the pound. One day last winter, I approached his house hoping to pet the dogs. Instead, I found a handwritten sign made of cardboard blocking the gate. "Flu season. Flu. Stay away," it read. Weird, I thought, shaking my head and walking up the street to work. Everyone on this block is weird. Everybody did have their quirks. I figured that this one was his. It was only much later that I realized he must have been trying to protect his compromised immune system. I also learned that it was best to approach him from close range, otherwise he couldn't recognize me. "Hang on a minute," he would say, squinting and tilting his head as he walked closer. "Oh, it's you! Oh, hey, you know, my vision's like the camera on Cops. Bounces up and down all the time. They say it's the back part that got damaged when I was in that car accident about 6 years ago. So it's hard to tell who it is from far away, since they're always moving." "Richie, how do you make the dogs do whatever you say? My dogs would run away if I took them out without a leash." "Well, they was born right here on the couch, so the way I see it, I'm the only god they know. Sure, their daddy was a pit and their mama was a rot, but they ain't got a bad bone in their body." Richie died at his home on 51st Street in Detroit in early July, 2005.
I woke up this morning, my baby's right by my side. The woman I've been living, Lord, 20 years ago. Lord, the woman I've been living with, Lord.
In Detroit, I learned how to spot abandoned houses by the stone in the roofs. But every time I leave, increasingly, it becomes harder and harder to come back. I've decided that Harlem is a key to happiness. Maybe. Like Detroit, but inhabited. In the meantime, I entertain myself by tossing off one postcard after the other from our ghost town into the void, counting up the nickels and dimes until I can disappear, without a trace, into the crowds in the streets. A Coney Island sideshow performer profiled in the New York Times last week said that each of the tattoos covering his body was a reminder of a place or episode in his past. This seems like a good way to remember Detroit, I think. Maybe a bird inked onto my skin. A graceful, delicate thing. Although a scavenging seagull might be the more accurate choice. And like all tattoo birds, it should be clutching something between its talons. Something like... what, exactly? A wrench? A lug nut? An empty bottle? A paper bag? A banner that reads, "I'm just trying to be real with y'all." You know what I'm saying? That's the thing about Detroit. You can't pin it down with a single iconic image. Instead, there's only a littered detritus. Debris blowing across the parking lot of my mind. Detroit is a smashed bottle, glittering rainbow colors in the sun. How could you tattoo that? When I'm grown up or just rich, I'll live somewhere else, but own a dilapidated mansion here. Maybe on Grand, maybe on the East Side. I'll keep a white Cadillac in the garage, and I'll come visit every now and then. Light a joint, and drive it around.
Thank you.
number two. When I first met Tom, the only instructions I got were, don't mention his ex-wife. Ever. But Tom was a true gentleman. He was shy, never smoked or drank. He was a deeply religious man, and we went to the same church on the east side. We both liked the rowdy demonstrative services. Black churches give you a show for your money, you know. This is a God I know, he had said. Tom was so tall that whenever he went into the basement office, he had to stoop, but he never complained. We'll never know if he killed himself on the Sunday on purpose or not, but here are the facts. He laid out his identification and the contents of his wallet neatly on the kitchen counter, taped his unused ticket to the ball game to the front door, went out to his new truck with a shotgun. It was true that he had a haunted vibe about him, but his divorce was a few years ago, and I never would have imagined it'd come to this. After his death, more and more things came out about Tom that I hadn't known. I knew of him as a truck driver and a union reformer. Did I know that he had also been a pastor? A Harvard graduate with a degree in theology? A commentator on NPR? But what I still didn't know was how such a gentle person could have inflicted such a violent death upon himself. I was telling Lauren, I have a recurring waking dream, and I'm sure she has a similar one. In it, I go into the basement office after hours, and Tom is there, hunched over his computer. Oh, hi, he says, as if nothing had ever happened. How are you, I ask. Or maybe that I suggest that he go home, or take a break. Oh, pretty good, he says. But you'll have to excuse me, he says, turning away from me and back to his desk. There's so much more to get done. Tom died on August 9, 2004, outside his home on Hubbard Street in Detroit. He was 49. He was also a commentator on National Public Radio, and several years before said the following during one of his programs. When we go it alone, when we deny our interconnectedness and miss the opportunity to mean something important to each other, we throw away the chance for real satisfaction and real beauty. Union wife, so you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union.
That was Rose White reading from Old Weird America on the Mixed Media Audio Zine.
You're listening to the most interactive station on the internet. This is the Global Voice.
I'd like to read a poem now from a great underground zine called Letter Founder, which is compiled by Jesse Kendall in Lewiston, Maine, and shared with people all over Maine and the world. This is a poem called Waterweave by Caroline Davison from Lewiston, Maine. A quiet trip to celebrate my birth on the peaceful pond with a reflective mind. The water ripples out in crimps like corduroy, small waves, large waves, undulating like life itself. So many of my choices are still moving outward, and I might never know how far my love will travel. And so I paddle on into this moment, looking behind yet also moving forward. I feel the connections, both lost and found. I see the fabric of my aging is woven of courage and hope. Thank you.
due. Going gray, the resistance to renew.
From a brand new split cassette tape from two bands, Letter and Poppet, that was Poppet with Wayward Notion, and that split tape is available from MsValerieParkDistro.com. I have another quick reading from a zine by Miranda and Dave. Their zine is called Real Life, A Magical Guide to Getting Off the Internet. And God only knows we spend way, way too much time on the internet. And this is a little piece called What Would You Rather Be Doing by Miranda. Is internet-free living realistic? How do you decide what is worth sharing online and what you'd rather keep to yourself? What is your online persona like compared to how you are in real life? How many times did you check your email today? How many times did you log into Facebook today? Why? These are big questions. They are for me, anyway. Sometimes I feel like we pretend that the internet isn't a thing for us. It's background noise and a bit of documentation of our real lives. So how did it become so intrusive? How much time spent online is too much? What would we rather be doing? And why aren't we doing it? I wrote a list. Finding, naming, and gathering plants. Reading tarot cards. Holding hands. Doing nothing. Wandering in the snow, drinking tea with a friend, writing a letter, reading a really good book, reorganizing and getting rid of stuff, actively breaking bad habits, working on my second novel, learning something, playing with my cats, positively screwing shit up, and making out. And then, of course, I started doing them. Go ahead and write your own list. What's on it? Why aren't you doing those things right now? And that's a brief reading from Real Life, A Magical Guide to Getting Off the Internet, a zine by Dave and Miranda, and that zine is available at schoolformaps.etsy.com. We're going to close out the program today with part two of Thomas and Slay's three-part series known as Weather.
We have other projects. We have stumbled upon them rather than actively taken them up. If someone has a good idea, we all tend to take an interest in it. David goes through the piles of old newspapers next to the fire and cuts out the sections relating to weather. He thinks that if we can map out the patterns from the recent past, we may be able to predict what might happen in the future. He stacks the maps in chronological order and writes out the temperature for each day in long, tidy rows. Both the highs and the lows. He looks for a pattern. We help him in quiet ways. Jane is writing an equation to figure out what might come next. It's 47 pages long. Dan sighs. The weather forecasters have not reappeared. At first we thought this would be a temporary shortage, but it shows no sign of abating. They have been gone for 4 months now. Sylvia maintains it has been 6 months. Carl looks out the window and says it has been at least 7. Facts are thin on the ground. We do know that the weather forecasters aren't here anymore and we have no way of finding out what the weather is going to be. There are no helpful isobars or weather maps, no small, glum symbols for the rain. Every morning we wake up and rush to the window. We press our faces against the panes of glass to see how the day will unfold. Most usually we get up before dawn. We are always getting up then. Francis gets out of bed first and puts some washing in the washing machine. Then we wait by the window until we are able to see what the weather will be. Some days it is sunny, and others the rain is coming down. There are a myriad of combinations and possibilities between and beyond these two parameters. It makes us all tired to have to get up so early. If it is sunny, Simon puts the washing on the line. As soon as we anticipate what the day will be like, we are immediately and vastly unsatisfied. We are consumed by the thought of the next day, even by the thought of that afternoon or the next hour. We ache to know what the sky will be like and how the temperature will change. Sue has a rain gauge that she uses to measure the rainfall. She records the amounts in a small notebook, where she has ruled the pages in two columns, one for the date and one for the amount of rain. Every morning, after we have seen the dawn, she goes across the backyard to the fence where the gauge hangs and takes down the level. In the silent hours between daybreak and breakfast, we wait for her to come back. When she does, we look tentatively at the new entry. We love this new, unknown information, but we are also scared of it. We love the way we can compare it to the other entries in the notebook. If there has been no rain, Sue counts the dew, the minuscule condensation that collects inside the container. She writes in the notebook, 0.009 mils. This satisfies us. We are utterly bereft if there is no data.
And that's going to do it for the June edition of Mixed Media Audio Zine right here on the Global Voice. I'd like to thank you for listening and invite you to comment on the show or participate by sending your own audio for possible inclusion in an upcoming edition. You can email me at fmoe@colby-sawyer.edu. That's FMOE, Frederick Michael Oscar Echo at colby-sawyer.edu. Mixed Media is heard on the Global Voice on the third Friday of the month at 1730 UTC, with repeats currently on the following Saturday at 6:30 UTC and Monday at 1630 UTC. This is DJ Frederick. Let's keep the spirit of independent music, writing, and radio alive.